Welcome back to Hunger for Wholeness. My name is Jillian Langford, and it's great to be back here again for part two of an interview with Dr. Matt Siegel. Dr. Siegel is a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he is a part of the Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness program. In the first part of this interview, Ilya, Gabby, and Matt talk all about process theology, about what it means for God to be in relationship, and how we reconcile the chaos of good and evil in the world. And in part two, they continue this conversation and focus on personhood, what it means for humans to be relational beings, what it means for humans to strive, and the relationship between the ecological crisis and human becoming. It's a great episode, but I highly recommend going and listening to part one to have some context into exactly what they're talking about in the second part of the interview. But if you've already done that, get ready to sit back, relax, and enjoy part two of this interview with Ilya Delio, Gabby Sloan, and Dr. Matt Siegel.
So I think one of the things I hear here that I'm beginning to realize is the way institutional religion has sidetracked us in some ways. You know, our attention or our awareness of who we are, what we have the capacity for, both ways, you know, for greatness and for evil. We have thrown, in a sense, our responsibilities and our hope for salvation, so to speak, onto a God. And I think that has not bode us well in this world. In other words, I think the problems of our age, you know, global warming, racism, genderism, everything that divides us, is that we're so out of sync with ourselves, and we're out of sync with everything else. Because I think we're searching, you know, we don't even know what holds us together anymore, it seems. You know, we're all over the place. Yeah. And I think there is this kind of, for some, you know, that this hope that there's going to be a God there who's going to intervene or, you know, do some special act of something or other. And that's just widening the problems. You know, that kind of thinking is actually making things worse. Because if we look at the human within the flow of evolution, we are this universe on the level of self-thought, you know, of the self-thinking consciousness. So it makes a difference. And I don't see religion as something dropped down or some special intervention, you know, I think sometimes of an MGM movie, you know, where you have the angels. But religion is, it's an outflow of conscious evolution. I mean, it emerges in evolution with the rise of consciousness. So in that sense, I don't like speaking about religious naturalism. I think those terms are unhelpful, quite honestly. It is rather, we become aware of this complex wholeness that we're involved in, you know, and it's this whole that seems to be in evolution. And that's why I think Whitehead and Teilhard really invite us to a whole new paradigm, not just kind of tweaking a few things like talking about just only relational God or, you know, a God who may not be omnipotent, even that though really scares us. But I mean, really a God who's just in the mix, you know, a God who is part of the whole. And for us to take, how do we grow up as humans? Maybe that's the question, you know, I wonder about, like, are we really even persons, or are we just wannabe persons, you know, people who really want to be relational beings?
Yeah, that's an important question. I've wondered that too. Are we actually even human yet, or is this more of an ideal that we're striving for? And so long as the world's broken up into nations and races and this history, this traumatic history we have of division, intra-species division,
yeah.
Are we really human yet? I mean, clearly the ideal is there on the horizon, and so many efforts have been made, visionary attempts to realize this vision are there in our history, but I don't know if we're there yet. I mean, it doesn't seem like we are.
Right. Gabby, you had thoughts here?
Yes, actually. I think that being human is actually like the state of becoming human, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think we would be human if we were already complete. I think that being human is the striving.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like that.
it's what allows us to like villainize people who aren't striving for that goal and dehumanize them. You know, they're not like Disney villains. Think Disney villains. Like, they're never striving for ultimate peace, so they're villains. It's like dehumanizing, if that makes sense. Like, also, like, you know, if God is a state of becoming, right, then it would make sense that, like, for him to become, we have to complete each other, you know, like, we're becoming complete and he's becoming complete through each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's spot on. That's really, it's profound in its own way. But we have no systems or symbols that really support that idea. Do you think so? Or in other words, I think that that's right on the right track. You know, I like what you're saying, Gabby, that we're not human. We're becoming. We're in that state of, it's an active dynamic state of becoming human. So, you know, let's not overrate ourselves. Like, we're like, yeah, we're human, you know, so like, maybe let's take that down a notch. You know, that's what we'd like to be when we grow up. You know, we want to be a human being, a human person. And God is enfolded, like, as we're becoming, God is becoming. And, you know, what kind of symbols or systems could we have that would support a divine human complex in motion? You know, this kind of complexified being, if I could use that, divine being or human being or whatever. A complexity is just that. You know, you can't really separate the elements. They're intertwined or interrelated. And so, again, I look around and, yeah, I think we're off the mark big time. And I don't see anything that's helping to move us, unless you do. Do you see anything that's helping to move us towards Whitehead's vision or Teilhard's vision or this vision of human becoming?
I think the ecological awakening in many ways is calling us to our senses literally and figuratively, and that through that, a lot of people are beginning to question the narratives of progress that are not actually progressive in our industrial civilization. But, you know, I actually think that a lot of the symbols and the rituals and the teachings that we need are right there in the world religions. We're just a literal, flat, patriarchal reading of these world religions has blinded us to the transformative insights that are there. Mm-hmm. Right? So I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel here. I think we just need to look again with more active imaginations and more openness and take responsibility for our interpretations of scripture, say, rather than thinking that it's just there on the page to be read like instructions. Like, you know, that's not how it works. So I'm a little, in a sense, I'm a little bit more optimistic, perhaps.
Oh, good.
Even though, you know, in many of my conversations with more fundamentalist religious believers who I seek out such conversations because I want to see it. Is it possible to speak in the language of the, usually it's Christianity, the religion to which they belong, to try to move them in a less isolated,
a binary,
a binary view of good and evil in the world. And to the extent that I have any success, it's because I have helped them see another way of interpreting one of their favorite scriptures or rituals, like what is the Eucharist really? So, you know, I think we can work within the world religions to re-enliven the symbols we already have. You know, Jung is very good on this question. You know, he would say, you can't just consciously, intellectually invent a new symbol or a new religion. That's not how it works, right? The unconscious psyche is working at a much deeper level. It has given rise to the world religions out of a real sense of human need that's greater than we're even consciously aware of most of the time. And we have to work with the material that's there.
Yes and no. I think I would challenge that a little bit insofar as if you think what the fastest evolver for us today is technology. Now, we've always had technology of some sort. You know, we build fires and, you know, build rock houses and stuff like that. But, you know, in the 20th century, we did something that seemed incredible. And that was had this machine that we tested that it could think like a human. And there was something there, I think, that's was threshold, now was there an archetype of, you know, of that within deep within the unconscious that we could actually build machines that could mimic human intelligence or that could speak to us? I mean, I far be it from me to say, but there's something about us humans that we have the capacity to create what has never existed before. We have the capacity to invent things that have never existed before. And I think, you know, computer technology is one of them, and building robots that mimic or mirror human function is rather, you know, incredible and will be soon more interspersed with our daily lives. To think that we could, for example, build a car and now we have robotically driven cars. So we have this amazing capacity to do incredibly new things. And I guess I do wonder when it comes to religion, why we're so conservative about it, you know, that we don't want to jettison what we inherited. And I would agree because there's such a richness in these traditions. And yet, there's nothing to say that we cannot invent new symbols because we are new beings. We're not the same beings that we were, you know, in the 16th century or the 13th century. We're really a new person. And so why not? Why not invent Google's become a symbol? The internet itself is a symbol. So we have the ability to create new symbols that speak to us, and they motivate us, and they inspire us to move forward. And maybe that's what I think with the question of symbolic renewal. I don't think the symbols that we have now, even with some slightly new interpretations, you know, are really doing much for us. I think a lot of people, certainly if I think of religion, it's a Sunday deal. You know, I mean, if I think of Christian, you know, I'm going to think of a monotheistic religion, in particular Christianity. But, you know, Monday through Saturday, I mean, there are not a lot of people. I'm not going to speak for everyone, but those symbols aren't really functioning in a 24/7 way. You know, I've wondered, are we too reserved when it comes to religion? We don't want to jettison what we've inherited, surely. But at the same time, we're very reserved about building new religious platforms, if I can use that word, back to technology. Mm-hmm. God 2.0, you know, Eucharist right. 3.0. I mean, what does this look like?
I would not want to restrict poets and artists of all kinds from creating new symbols and new languages, new ways of symbolically participating in the divine and evoking spirit in the world. Certainly not. But often some of the most profound art and poetry is, again, sort of working with the material that's there in culture that could be thousands of years old. But I kind of resist the idea that religion is a kind of technology or a social technology. I think technology obviously has transformed the world and will continue to do so. And I cautiously embrace that, though I think technologies, the innovation right now is not driven, it's not motivated by the type of vision for the world that I think it could and should be motivated by. But, you know, I think it's true that we have machines now that can mimic human beings and human thinking. But mimicry is not the same as actually realizing conscious thought. I'm not saying it's not possible for some future technology, maybe biotechnology, to pull this off. But even back in Descartes' day, hundreds of years ago, they had automata that, from our point of view, with our standards, were clunky and like not that impressive. But nonetheless, without electricity and without any microchips, you know, there were humanoid machines that do tricks and impress people. And this is part of what led Descartes to his thought experiment, looking out of his window, seeing people walking on the street in their robes with hoods on, like, oh, those could just be, I don't know if they're real people, they could just be machines. But the point here is this mimicry of the human through mechanistic means. It's been with us for many centuries already. Obviously, they're more impressive today. But I think there's a distinction that we have to make between mimicry and the genuine article. And there's also a sense in which we're so inundated by artificial forms of intelligence. For many of us, you know, I teach online, and so most of my day is this interface. And I think if we're not careful, we might become more machine-like, just as the machines are becoming more human-like. And rather than one day machines becoming conscious, it's more like we're meeting in the middle, right? We've lowered our standards, as it were, because we've lost touch with our own living, breathing consciousness and human form of thinking. So I'm cautious about these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you cautious as well, Gabby? I'm just curious.
I'm a very cautious person. I'm cautious about a lot of things, you know. I'm cautious when I get out of the shower not to slip and fall. I'm always cautious of like human-made things and stuff because like, however, like, how do I put it? You know how like we talk about like God not being complete and God in the realm of perfection? Like the idea of a machine, you know, that can be like a person is kind of like in the realm of perfection. And then in the realm of reality, it's like, it's motivated by human desires. Like the creation of it, I mean, is motivated by human desires and things. So like, even, so if we assume that like AI that is human and has conscious thought is possible and a realistic good goal, we would have to also count on human intentions being good. So, you know, I don't think the AI itself is going to take over the world of its own volition, but I think that people with bad intentions could use it poorly. It's a tool.
So maybe going back to that God question, I mean, I wonder, like, if we are to perfect God, do you think we're really trying to be God through our technology? In other words, technology gives us God powers, and how we use those God powers makes a huge difference. Like, we can either be good gods for the world, or we can be evil gods for the world. But there is something about technology, I think, that's deeply tied to religion, you know, and sometimes, I mean, this is stuff that other scholars have written, you know, that technology really is a new type of religion. I was actually just looking over Brett Robinson's Appletopia. It's a book he wrote back in 2013 on Steve Jobs and spirituality and new religion. And he has all sorts of photos like Steve with the new iMac, and it looks like the incarnation, like the baby Jesus, you know, born with Walter Cronkite and John Lennon and, you know, all the cultural figures surrounding him, you know, so the new savior is the iMac. He speaks about Apple stores as new cathedrals, like people don't go to church anymore, but they go to the Apple store on Sunday, you know, and it's like a ritual, you know, and so the rituals of the computer world or the rituals of technology. And it's kind of interesting, you know, and, you know, basically, I think they're saying like we're finding something that has comparable religious meaning or value in technology that we don't find in the institutional religions. There's something there that's connecting us in a more godly way and an empowering way. You know, in the past, I think religion did serve sort of like, I would agree, it's not really technology, but spirituality was like a harnessing of the spirit, you know, it sort of directed, you know, our lives. And now technology does that. Technology functions similarly as a direction of our lives, you know, for better or worse. And that's why I think if we don't bring technology and religion together, these things are really all over the place and really are ripe for whoever has the most money and the most power to, you know, to develop things, that they're the ones that have the final say on the planet.
I mean, I think your first point was dead on, that they're not, we don't need to bring them together so much, because technology already does carry this religious function for most people. I mean, the religious symbolism.
Exactly.
Is
right. the symbol of the apple.
Plucked from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And
exactly.
Knowledge as power is the view of knowledge that has won out in the modern West. And it is a view, it's an instrumentalism, right? That to know something means to be able to control it, to reverse engineer it, to build a copy of it. And this is, it's changed the world. It's in many ways, lifespans have been increased. Average human lifespans have been increased, but war has become unbelievably more devastating also,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's many sides to this. And then the profit motive that underlies the research and development and distribution and consumption mechanisms of our economy also are, for the most part, what drives the evolution of technology. And I think what could be possible if other motives for research and design and invention were in the driver's seat?
Right.
In terms of spiritualizing or bringing religion and into technology more consciously, I think that's where I would start to get more excited is, you know, can we shift away from just trying to control more and more and to increase shareholder profits more and more by producing the right kind of consumables? Because, you know, there's no question that as amazing as an iPhone is, updating it every year is not really to improve the technology, maybe a little bit here and there. It's really to force everybody to upgrade every year. There's a lot of things that could have been in a model 5 years ago that they hold off on because if they spread it out. And so there's just these other motivations that are, I think, inhibiting the potential of technology to improve the human condition.
Yeah, driven by the power of the dollar. I have to tell you, I have an Android, so I'm a Google.
There you
Google.
Go.
So yes. I'm not part of that cult of there Apple. You go. But Gabby is.
There you go, Gabby, yeah.
What do you think is the most, I mean, we've covered a wide range of things here. What do you think is the most pressing issue of our age?
I mean, we're on the verge of nuclear war again as a result of nationalism, which is not that far from, you know, racism. This sense of, again, intra-species division with the technology that we have, the humanity cannot survive another world war, you know, and with the trajectory that we're on ecologically, with the ways that one bad harvest can ripple, leading to mass migration, leading to, again, a amplification of this, the dark impulse toward fascism and nationalism when you have, you know, desperate migrants trying to immigrate into a country because of whatever famine somewhere driven by climate change. Like all these things are, there's a cascade of catastrophes underway, and we're as yet unable to act as a human community, as a planetary civilization, to address issues that affect everyone, regardless of what language you speak, regardless of where you were born. There's one planet. And so it's not just one issue I'm talking about here, unless that is the challenge of the human being waking up to itself as one being. Because if we can't do that, a multitude of literally world-ending problems we're going to be faced with. And so,
yeah. Gabby, do you agree with Matt? I mean, on the question?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a lot of problems right now. Like just the fact that we can say, yeah, we're on the brink of nuclear war again is like kind of insane to me. I think the biggest issue really of this age, whatever you want to call it, is us, because like somewhere along the line in our like human becoming, we've hit our like rebellious teenager phase, but like worse. And so now we're like, you know, oh, let's destroy the planet. And we're kind of waking up to it now to some extent. But I mean, it's like we're learning that our actions have consequences.
Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I mean, if you both brought up the reality of the possibility of nuclear war, and there's no like signs, you know, I mean, there's not going to be like some announcements on television, or, you know, you'll get Yahoo blurbs or Google and, you know, oh, you know, this is a special announcement. A nuclear missile has been attacked. I mean, it's going to be so sudden. And I think this is the thing. We are not prepared for the world that we have built. And I think this is one of the difficulties. We have built a world, I think, that's too large for us. It's too complex. It gives us the illusion of stability, but in fact, it's very fragile and seems to be almost like a global landmine, you know, that we don't know exactly where we stand if we take the next step, if we're going to survive this. How do you think we should live in this world? I mean, do you think we should just keep on same old, you know, another day, another bright sun shining in our faces? Or is there a way we should really take a pause? I think you both said, you know, it's awakening up to our own humanity. And here I do think the spiritual traditions, you know, the richness of these traditions that call us back to what we used to call in the Christian tradition, self-examination, like, who am I, you know, and what do I want, you know, and how am I acting this day? Do you think something like that, you know, do you think we need to pause and reevaluate, you know, what we are and how we're going about this world and the things we take for granted, you know, the things we expect, we live every day with as if we expect, you know, to have oxygen to breathe and a sun to shine and water to, you know, to nurture our plants and make our flowers grow. When in fact, nothing of this is necessary. You know, it's really all in the contingencies of life. And, you know, I think one of the things from Teilhard's view is I think we have failed. And this is where I think religion could play a better part to really get our heads around the fact that we are in evolution. We're an evolving species, right? We were never meant to stay the same. You know, we were never meant to stay as is. And somehow we developed this, and I do think it's more of an illusion because it's not reality, that we've always been this way and we will always be this way. And, you know, these kind of movements, I think it's what technology has done for us. It has really converged us. It has drawn together, not just persons, but, you know, collectives, both locally and globally, and we're resisting those collectives. We don't want to be together, you know, as nation states. We don't want to be together as different colored people and with different languages and different ways of viewing things. But the fact is, I think what technology says, we are together. This is our one planet. And I think our present systems were developed in a different age. They're not bad. They were just developed at a different time. But we didn't realize the magnitude of our being together, what this could actually mean. And so, you know, I just wonder, this is why I do think technology is a gift, but we're not realizing that gift for what, you know, and maybe building on it. You know, how can we turn to now live in a new way?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the ways we need to reorient is away from thinking that, I mean, the dominant religion in the Western world right now is money, capitalism, right? And I think it does function as a religion and technology, let's call it technologism, the idea that technology is just a ramp up into endless progress of increasing convenience and whatever. That whole ideology distracts us from the wonder that we would otherwise take in each moment of our existence with each breath that we take, that saying is a gift, really. Each moment is a gift. But we're in such a rush for the next upgrade or for the next improvement or for the next buck that we miss what's essential to life and cosmogenesis. And as human beings, or as we strive to become human beings, I think the key is in the thing we need to reorient towards is learning as the, an education as really the core of our existence and the purpose of our existence. And, you know, that allows us to be in this wonder and to marvel not only at the intricacy of the world and the majesty of the evolutionary process, but to cultivate our own intelligence and our own sensitivity, because as you're saying, it's not fixed. The nature of the human soul and body is in process.
Right.
And the ways that we engage with that process and the ways that we become more sensitive to certain possible avenues for our future evolution are going to determine the future.
Yeah.
And if we sleepwalk into that future and just allow other motives to be in the driver's seat, we're not going to like where we end up.
I fully agree. Gabby, you have thoughts here or questions?
I do. And also my ride home is here and my battery is at 3%.
Okay.
But yeah, I completely agree. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thanks, Gabby. Yeah. I want to just say, man, I think I like the emphasis on learning, but knowledge and going back to knowledge, not as this kind of informational, you know, consumerism, which is, it's, you know, we just can't take in enough. But knowledge is that exploration of the mind to really pursue the depths of the questions of truth and beauty, you know, what the ancients pursued. What is goodness? What is the good life? You know, what is truth? What are we here for? I mean, and going back to that kind of contemplative, you know, knowledge as the contemplation of reality in that truest sense. And I think knowledge has been just, it's been transferred into this kind of informational glut and then packaged in a consumer, like, you know, you need this degree or you need to get this, you know, to become smarter and, you know, get promoted and get wealthier and all the wrong things around knowledge. And I think we have failed to realize the capacity of the human mind to shape, you know, to be an artisan, to be a creator, like a poet, one who can evoke new images and new ways of being that could deepen life on this planet, you know, and in this cosmos.
Yeah, knowledge, learning is not about information. It's about formation, which is yes. to say, Bildung, as the German idealist would put it, you know, forming yourself into the instrument that can know more deeply. It's not just consuming data.
Right. Yeah. But it's so, again, like everything else, I think in our culture, we've flattened out the knowing process. And it's, I think, what, you know, a lot of our world is a flattening out of things, whether it's religion or our ability to create. Everything is, as you say, you know, flattened out into literally the dollar, you know, and that becomes then the lodestar for everything else. And our values, that value is so not only misguided, it is actually detrimental, I think, to the welfare of our collective life on this planet. And of course, the Earth is really the one, you know, the non-human Earth creatures and the suffering of the systems that we continue to unconsciously really devastate and erode and just manipulate to our own advantage. We have to pay a price for this. It's not an option, you know. So I guess maybe in our last minute here, you know, what's one or two things that process theology or process thought offers to us as glimmers of hope? You know, what two maybe points of look this way? Mm-hmm.
Well, we do have a pretty well-developed scientific understanding of the history of the universe, which Teilhard in The Human Phenomenon, his book, tries to make us see. Because it's a book of nature, and written in that book is countless examples of achievements of organization and beauty that if you looked at the prior moment of evolution, say before atoms formed into the first stars or the first stars organized into galaxies, you never would have seen that coming, mm-hmm. right? Or the fact that, you know, dying stars would give rise to the heavier elements that allowed carbon-based life forms to emerge billions of years later. There's a sequence of creative emergence. We're waking up in the midst of a sequence that long predates us. And so there's much that we can feel supported by when we look at the history of the universe. And in a way, miracles happen. Where a miracle is, as you were saying earlier, something new emerges, right? Unexpected in a way, in excess of anything that came before it. But we have examples of this spillover, this excess of creativity. And so there's hope in that. Even when things seem dark and it seems like there's no way to escape the closing down of possibilities in our very sort of troubled world right now. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's coming. We don't know what's possible.
Right.
And I think process theology also gives us hope in the ways that we inherit our religious traditions, that it's clear that many, you know, there's the old secularization thesis that as societies become more technologically advanced, they grow out of religion. And the 20th century was kind of hooked on this idea, and it turns out not to be true.
Right.
But luckily, those religious traditions, as I was saying earlier, can be interpreted in new ways, and that those novel interpretations can have opposite effects to some of the more, you know, disturbing forms of culture and and manifestations politically that I think dogmatic interpretations have had in the past, right? So there's more interpretive potential there, and process theology exemplifies that.
That's great. So I think that's a good note to end. A wider scope and always kind of keeping the big picture, you know, never to lose sight of the big picture and the depth picture, you know, and you mentioned Teilhard's vision, you know, to see, to really see, you know, not just superficially see, but to see the depths of things. And to realize that we are here after a long, long process of evolutionary life in which there's been countless really explosions and cataclysmic events and biological upheavals. And so, you know, all that we're experiencing in our own age really is part and parcel of the whole evolutionary flow. And yet I do think that, you know, I like, you know, your emphasis on the fact that the religious traditions do have a value, you know, and maybe in some ways extreme value today, you know, but they need to be a little bit reinterpreted for our own age. But to say that this universe has meaning and purpose, it's not just a random happening. It's not just something that can be, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, that there's something taking place even in our midst that maybe we're not often attentive to. Maybe that is the emergence of God. You know, it's a power of some sort. It's a power that we humans ourselves cannot control. Because even if we were to damage this earth severely, life will continue on here. And life will continue in the universe. You know, that we are one planet amongst millions and millions of planets. And so I think maybe we just need to widen our eyes and widen our hearts and widen our minds and get out of ourselves a little bit and to say that this universe really is a pretty incredible place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pretty awesome life that we can experience.
Yeah, well said.
Thank you, Matt. It was really great to talk to you. And I love the fact that you're so wide read on so many different areas. And you're a real philosopher too. I can see your attention to the details of things. So let's keep up the good work on your side and keep process philosophy active and alive and make the word available wherever we can.
Thanks so much, Ilya. It was great to talk to you.
Great. Be well.
Thank you for listening to part two of this interview with Gabby Sloan, Dr. and Sister Ilya Delio, and Dr. Matt Siegel. If you want to learn more about Matt Siegel and his work, he blogs at footnotestoplato.com. That's footnotes, the number two, and Plato, like the philosopher.com. This podcast is made possible through generous support from our friends at the Fetzer Institute. Ilya Delio was your host today, along with co-host Gabby Sloan. My name is Jillian Langford. I'm the producer of this podcast, and Kate Christensen is our fabulous social media and marketing manager. If you want to stay up to date on everything Hunger for Wholeness, make sure to follow us on social media or on Instagram and Twitter as Hunger for Wholeness. And you can also become a donor and support this podcast by giving and becoming a subscriber on patreon.com. And in exchange, we'll give you a little bit of a background into the behind the scenes of what we do, how we make this podcast possible, and even let you ask some interview questions to our upcoming guests. So until next time, this has been A Hunger for Wholeness.